Two bills that appear on the agenda that we're not going to hear today unless someone absolutely wants to provide testimony or fill us in with information. Senate Bill 1071 and Senate Bill 1098. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1070. Senator Przanski, why don't you come forward? And we've got Greg Wasson in the batting cage. Thanks.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Welcome. And I know you've got another committee, so.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4. Senate Bill 1070 is a bill that would actually require the legislature, upon the successful enactment of a citizen initiative in the November general cycle, to come into the next regular session, which would be the following January, about 60 days later, and to actually identify its funding mechanisms or sources to pay for whatever new services that are being expanded or provided to the citizens through the citizen initiative process. All this will do is actually require the legislature to say how they're going to fund the that initiative. And the purpose for that is to make certain everyone understands that when we pass a measure as a citizen initiative in November that requires requires money to be spent from the state to implement it, that we identify how we're going to pay for it. It could be modifying current budgets for different programs and taking away from current programs that are being funded by state dollars. It could be a new revenue source that might be implemented by the legislature. I'll give you an example of the IP40, which is the mandatory minimum sentencing for property crimes. That measure, if it's successful and in passing in November of this year, it will cost the state, has been guesstimated, at somewhere between $200 and $450 million per biennium. So you can see that's a pretty significant amount of money. And it's important, I believe, for us as the legislature to actually let the public know after they have passed one of these type of measures how we plan on funding the implementation of it. And the importance of that is that once we identify that, if for some reason someone from the citizenry chose not to support our funding mechanism for those initiatives, they have the right to do what's known as a referendum. They could refer a referendum the bill that it would be actual funding of the initiative to the voters, and the voters would then have a decision to make whether or not they agreed with our funding sources and process of paying for that new service or expanded service. If they vote the funding mechanism, the bill down that would actually provide the funding, then the Senate Bill 1070 provides that the legislature would not have a duty to implement that measure at that moment, and that we would have to come back during the next session and actually come up with a new funding mechanism until we satisfied the voters. This is kind of an accountability for all of us that would be voting for an initiative to realize that there is, in some cases, a decision that needs to be made of how we pay for various services that are being mandated through the approval through the citizen initiative process. And it also would give us the guidance from the citizenry if they chose not to follow our means of funding and providing the service to be, actionable and responsible to the individual citizenry as to how we may fund it in the future. So it's really a truth and accountability as to how we pay for citizen initiatives when we don't require and that we can't require in the initiative a funding source. And it does not put an obligation on this on us to basically take the general fund money that is currently dedicated in three components, education, public safety, and health and human services, and say we're going to take money away from those three components to pay for this other service without having a discussion that's how we want to do it before we do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Przanski. Questions?
Well, just a comment, because so many of the initiatives, they sound good, and yes, we want them, but I don't think the public knows that if we fund one, then that means we're taking money away from either adding more money to public safety, but within public safety, we are taking money away from whatever programs are within public safety, or taking it away from the general fund, taking money away from public education or health services.
That's, if I may, Madam Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, I think that's exactly how we as the legislature have been acting. Instead of maybe looking at new or additional revenue sources to pay for that additional service that now has been approved by the voters, we're more inclined to take money away from other areas where I know, at least in my constituency, many individuals will come to me and say, well, why did you defund a specific area, be it public safety, another component of it, if we're looking at IP40, if you're looking at health and human services, or in the education arena. And every time I have this conversation with individuals, no one has ever said, well, I meant for you to take money away from these existing programs that the services that the state provide. They just have a belief that we can just absorb these new and additional costs. And clearly we may be coming into a cycle where the economy is going to be going into a downturn, and I think it's even more imperative that we have a little bit more disclosure as to how we are going to fund these programs, and not be acting on what many people in my district have called unfunded mandates, because there's no additional resources for those programs.
Sarah Atkinson.
Thank you. How would these impacts be put together? I mean, would they be estimated? Who would do that?
Well, right now, whenever we have any bill, let's say that deals with criminal law, there are numbers that are ran through through the LFO, let's say fiscal office, that are basically taking the projections based on the agencies that are implementing as to what the impact financially will be. And so whenever we pass a bill, a policy bill that requires additional funding, or funding, I should say, we are already faced with that determination. So I expect that it's going to be exactly the same.
So, but I don't see it in the bill. Maybe it is. But so it's the revenue office that will, or the fiscal office that will make that determination?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I would expect that we would use the standard procedure that we currently use for any policy bills that we're looking at, and it will be ran through. I mean, clearly, whenever we have an initiative that's passed in November, there's a requirement for implementation language to actually move that bill forward, and part of it is a funding mechanism. And I just believe that it's important and imperative that we identify it so everyone knows how we're paying for that service, be it an expanded service or a new service. And then if the voters say we disagree with that means or approach for funding, then we, the legislature, are not obligated to have that implemented until we come up with a adequate and sufficient funding source that the public would support and agree with.
Sir Atkinson,
just one comment. I guess my concern about this is the politicizing of. I mean, certainly there's two schools of thoughts about the People's Initiative, but I'm concerned about the politicizing of a with huge fiscal impacts that may or may not come to pass. I guess I'm concerned about some of those numbers being politicized. That just an effort to defeat a measure. That's
no
political
concern. Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, you're putting the cart before the horse. In this particular case, the measure will have already passed.
Okay.
It will have passed in November. Come January, when we come into session, we now have a duty to maintain a balanced budget. We also have a duty to implement the initiative that has been passed. And so in doing so, what I want to do is identify for the people, once they've passed it, this is how we're funding it. Just what, if you remember what became ballot measure 30, when we're looking at the various revenue sources that we needed to pay for services within the state. When it was referendum to the voters voted it down. And all of a sudden we found ourselves in a grave position of having services that we had either traditionally paid for or provided for, and that we had already, or ones that were coming in new, that we no longer had the revenue to pay for that. And so that's the point. It's actually
Thank you for the clarification. I apologize. I was late. Didn't get the timeline. So thank you.
Yeah. This is. I want to put this on the record, if I can, Madam Chair. There is no indication or tendency on my part to actually limit the citizen initiative process as to what people bring forward and we vote on as citizens of the state as to what should or shouldn't be part of our policies. It's just once that decision is made that we want this new service or expanded service program, that we have to have a means of paying for it that is accountable to the voters, and if the voters agree with it, then it's done. If they don't, then we should not be required to cut other programs that they think are just as essential, that are vital to our state, to now implement that program until we come up with whatever policy to pay for it.
Thank you. Sarah Montesanderson.
Well, it's just that you're taking this approach rather than having a funding mechanism to go along with whatever initiative comes forward.
Madam Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I believe that we would hear from our legislative council that we would be basically mixing multiple issues into one measure, and you're basically asking them to say, yes, I want this service, and then you're also saying, but if I want the service, I'm going to have to agree to the funding source, and that's two questions in basically one initiative, and I believe that that has been discussed before and has been found to violate the single subject rule.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. Appreciate your time. Mr. Wasson, it's good to see you.
Thank you for the welcome. My name is Greg Wasson, and I'm still the only member of the Committee for Petition Rights. I don't think that the legislature, as an independent, the current legislature cannot tell a future legislature what to do. If this idea is to be adopted as policy in this state, it has to be put in the Constitution, not statutes. This, as I understand constitutional law, this would be superfluous language littering the ORS and just make it more difficult to read what the law really is. The same way what the statute that says that laws take effect on January 1, that legislature couldn't tell you what to do. So I just think that it's most people in this building do not have a good appreciation of what their true power is or true authority. Their power and authority are two different things, and I think this confuses the issue.
Thank you. Wait. I have to check to make sure anybody has any questions. Anybody? I guess you're off the hook. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1070? Come on.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Meek, testifying on my own behalf. This bill seems to be extremely broad and an extremely broad imposition on initiative rights. The clause that I would focus on begins on line 12 of the bill, which states that if the measure, if the funding measure is subject to a referral a referendum, then the Legislative Assembly is not obligated to fund implementation of the changes to law made by the state initiative measure, and the state initiative measure is not required to be implemented. Well, those are two different things. Many measures can have both regulatory or programmatic elements as well as elements that are not part of any program. For example, let's say that an initiative passes to regulate payday lenders. One part of that initiative may establish a program for regulating payday lenders that may well cost more than $100,000 and may well trigger the provisions of this bill, although I agree with Mr. Wasson that this bill would not be constitutional. However, let's say that the same initiative also said, and by the way, usurious loans are not enforceable. Now, that doesn't cost the state anything to enforce. Yet, what this bill purports to do is to nullify that provision of the initiative as well, even though it has no funding requirement attached to it, because it adds the clause and the state initiative measure is not required to be implemented. I can think of many other examples, including those involving initiatives that I've been involved in, like campaign finance reform. It has both regulatory elements, like changing the reporting requirements, which may well cost some money to implement, but it also has mandatory requirements that don't have any monetary number associated with them, like now there's a limit on what can be contributed to a political campaign instead of having unlimited. There's no monetary administration number attached to that. Nevertheless, this bill would nullify the entire initiative, including the parts that don't require any funding. So I would say this is extremely broad, ought to go back to the drawing board. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify? All right. Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1070, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1083. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us what we have?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1083 is before you. As printed, it directs the Supreme Court to rule on a ballot title petition not later than 30 days after it's filed, requires the Secretary of State to verify each signature on an initiative or referendum petition, and various other provisions.
Thank
you.
And
we have two amendments provided by Senator Walker.
Thank you. Senator Walker, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator from District 7, and seated to my left, your right, is Gina Zedlick, the newest Legislative Council staffer. And I have her here because I just got my amendments back at 3:15 and frantically copied them, and I may have trouble finding some things that I need, and she is also here to explain for if we have any questions. So let me state that Senate Bill 1083 is a pretty big bill. It's related to elections, and the Dash 1 amendments are pretty much the omnibus amendments. The Dash 2 is a standalone amendment, not supported by the Secretary of State's office, and I'll get to that in a moment. There are two parts of the bill that are pretty major. I want to get to the minor things before I get to the major things. The major things are the signature verification issue and then the voter challenge piece that talks about vote caging, which you may not be aware of what that is. I did see Senator Atkinson leafing through the book that I've provided to you. So let me talk about the minor things that start out in the bill. In Section 1, we simply make a very simple change. Originally, the change had asked that ballot titles describe the legal effects. Madam Chair, as you well know, being a lawyer, sometimes legal language is not the plain language, so we decided to drop that, and we just pluralized. Is that a word, pluralized? Maybe. We just added a plural to the word effects so that we would have more, if there is more than one major effect to a ballot title, we would add an S. So that's very simple. Section 2 of the bill is the part that directs the Supreme Court to take care of ballot title petitions within 30 days. The attempt at this language was to make it 30 days upon submission of filings so that it gives the court a true 30 days. The way it was written in the original bill, it sort of gave the court 16 days. So Ms. Zedlick changed it to 45 days to really give us the 30. We're going to continue to work with the Supreme Court on that. They don't have any objection to us putting timelines on them that I know of. But also I think it's more of an advisory because we are three separate branches of government. I don't think we can tell the Supreme Court what to do, but we can at least give them the advice that we'd like to have these taken care of sooner rather than later because it's critical for people who are filing initiative petitions. Section 3 is the part that talks about the initiative petition signature process. I'm going to skip that for the moment. Section 4 is the political, the vote caging and the voter challenges. I want to skip that. And then go to Section 5 of the bill. Section 5 of the bill requires the Secretary of State not later than 90 days after receiving a complaint regarding an initiative, referenda, or recall to resolve the complaint or dropkick it over to the AG's office or dismiss it. Currently, they have some cases that are up to 2 years old at this point. So I met with the Secretary of State's office. The amendment still gives them 90 days, but it gives them an opportunity at the end of the 90 days to provide notice why they may need an extension of time. But at no time will that take more than 1 year from the date of filing of the complaint. The Secretary of State's office is happy with that amendment. Section 6 of the bill, I don't think that does anything. It's in here. You took it out. Okay. So then we move to Section 7, which is giving the Secretary of State the opportunity to obtain and use records of the United States Postal Service to verify accuracy of addresses and update them automatically. I changed the may to a shall. And, Madam Chair, we must have been speaking to the same people because I see that you have a bill that has a similar provision in it. So those are the simple sort of things in the bill that I think are good public policy. Let me get back to the voter registration or the voter signature verification piece in Section 3. As you know, we've had a problem with that of late. Oregon's time-honored initiative system has been worn around the edges in recent years, and indeed it has been severely tested in recent weeks. Judge Michael Mossman in the Lemons case said, quote, if there's anything that should trouble the Secretary of State here, it's the difficulty the state has had in actually articulating the standard to be applied to these differing judgments in different counties. So originally this bill had asked that all signature verification come into the Secretary of State's office and we verify every signature. That was creating a problem. That was too big of a bite at the apple to chew. So I met with the Secretary of State. They do want to bring the signature verification into their office for the same reason I want it there. You can provide consistency in training, standardization in the application, which is what Judge Mossman was concerned about, and we can have an opportunity to have the signatures verified at two levels of verification. So the Secretary of State agreed to provide two levels of verification for both accepted and rejected signatures, because in the Lemons case, they learned from their own expert witness that many of the signatures that were approved, a high statistical sample anyway, should not have been approved. So this would help both sides of the system. You'll see the standalone amendment, the -2, that also goes an additional step and allows a rejected a signature from an elector to challenge that rejection. That's not supported by the Secretary of State, so I left it as a standalone amendment, and there are folks here who will testify about that today. The final large piece of the bill has to do with vote caging and vote challenges. Vote caging is the practice of sending non-forwardable direct mail to registered voters, using the return mail to then compile lists of voters, and they call them caging lists. And then they create those lists, and then they challenge voters and say, you're not registered to vote, you're a fraudulent voter, et cetera, et cetera. As you can well imagine, and as the evidence introduced in civil litigation has shown, partisan caging operations are directed consciously and specifically at jurisdictions with large numbers of minority voters. These operations are done specifically to disenfranchise voters. There's a wonderful resource that I've provided to you through the committee administrator. The report is titled Caging Democracy, A 50-Year History of Partisan Challenges to Minority Voters. It is published by Project Vote. It is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that is a leading technical assistance and direct service provider to the civic participation community. The report is available on the web for those who are listening at www.projectvote.org. I've also provided you with written testimony of Project Vote's Deputy Director Michael Slater, who indicates, and I'm just going to quote one section because you can read his testimony, the right to challenge the eligibility of another voter has been a part of election codes of many states for most of the past century and beyond. Unfortunately, challenge laws have been increasingly co-opted by partisan political parties, groups, and even individuals as a means to interject partisan politics into into the public administration of elections and to interfere with the administration of elections. I won't go into the detailed history of vote caging because the report you have and the testimony of Mr. Slater does that for you. But I will indicate that Oregon, while Oregon has not seen this kind of activity, it has occurred in states all across the nation, beginning in the 1950s in Arizona, escalating to federal, state, and local elections in New Jersey, Louisiana, North Carolina, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Washington State, Michigan, and Nevada, to name only a few. These violations of election law have caused states to pass their own laws regarding vote caging and vote challenging. There is a federal consent decree that came out of New Jersey between the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee that they would no longer engage in vote caging. It was the DNC who had sued the RNC. That has gone through a couple of modifications. I think the most final modification on that consent decree was in 1987. But the consent decree only says you cannot do this with national parties. So that's why states have taken it upon themselves to pass their own voter challenge laws and vote anti-vote caging laws. And you will see this, you won't see unless you go look at the laws, but my bill has taken the law from Minnesota and Washington State to craft a bill that you see before you. I will also tell you that Congress has two bills before it on this issue, one in the Senate and one in the House. And the one in the Senate, I believe Mr. Slater emailed me yesterday and said that we'll have a hearing next week. So this is of national concern. It's of local and state concern. It's done by both political parties. It was done by the Democratic Party in King County, Washington State. The booklet that you have with the 50-year history shows, however, that one party, the Republican Party, had done more of it than any other party. And it was actually involved in the firings. It came to light in the firings of some of the U.S. attorneys who were fired, because three of the attorneys who had been fired did not want to pursue fraud charges against those who have been accused of vote caging. So that is my bill. It's pretty large. It's probably going to have a couple of more amendments, but I will leave it at that if you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Sarah Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the United States Postal Service share address records with Secretary of State?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, you can purchase those records, yes.
Oh. I guess, Madam Chair, I was under the impression that because of heightened security concerns that you can buy mailing lists, but not from the U.S. Postal Service.
Well, apparently we can, Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, because the Secretary of State's office and I have chatted about this, and they say that they can do that. And my suggestion is that I think Senator Brown's bill indicates you update quarterly. My suggestion, I just left it blank. They can do it twice a year, quarterly, I don't care. But it helps automatically update the records. But you don't just automatically do that. You have to send out notice, because even the Postal Service has records that are incomplete and inaccurate. So it's really important to send notice to the voter, because our job here is to enfranchise people. We're not out to disenfranchise people, and so should take a more proactive role, particularly young folks who move a lot. Young people go to school, they go off to school, maybe they're registered at their mom and dad's address, and then they forget, and they graduate from college, and they go somewhere else, and they're still registered with mom and dad. So,
follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Ferrioli, sure.
I was just thinking of the incident where somebody took a proactive role and posted the driver's license information on the Internet, and the flap that created. And it was basically all the DMV records were all searchable in a searchable database on the Internet. And that, people got very upset by that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if you don't see a similar sort of reaction to people's having knowledge that their names and addresses were being that their information, their postal addresses are being, you know, sort of made universally available.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I would point out that Ms. Sedlick indicated in the statute that the county clerks can already do this, and they have been doing it. They just don't do it consistently, which is why I've asked to move that process into the Secretary of State's office so it can be done consistently.
Thank you very much.
Senator Walker, just to clarify, you said there were additional amendments you were expecting?
Well, we're still, Madam Chair, we're still trying to work out the wording with the Supreme Court on the day, and I suspect that there's a couple folks here who wanted to testify about the vote caging piece asked why was it limited just to political parties. That was the language that came from Minnesota and Washington, but you could certainly include 527. Political action committees and even individuals in that. So I just want to hear today from people and see if there's anything else that they're interested in changing.
Thank you. So you're not wanting to move the bill today. That was what I was getting at.
Mostly because of the Supreme Court. I want to be show proper deference to the Supreme Court and make sure we get that correct.
Okay, great. Any other questions for Senator Walker? Thank you very much. Senator Farioli.
I was a little late in arriving at the committee. Did we hear any testimony on the bill one way or the other from the county elections officials?
She just was the first person to testify on this bill. So,
thank you.
Ms. Coleman's here, so I'm anticipating she will testify. Okay, let's bring up Sal Peralta, Greg Wasson, and Cappy Eaton. Good afternoon and welcome.
Hi. Would you like me to start?
Please, okay. Since you were the first on the list.
The early bird, eh? Madam Chair, distinguished senators, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm speaking here today as chief petitioner on Initiative Petition 3 and as an Oregon elector. I've been following the Secretary of State's implementation of the various rules and regulations that pertain to Oregon's initiative and referendum system. I note that the liabilities for circulating initiative petitions in Oregon have increased, along with the disclosure requirements that include total transparency with regard to financial disclosures, disclosures of financial records, including attaching employee time cards to copies of the signature sheets. I recognize the importance of such disclosures in regulating the initiative process in light of past abuses, and agree that the state has an interest in preserving the integrity of Oregon's initiative and referendum system. I would argue, however, that preserving the integrity of the Oregon system also involves the creation of assurances for petitioners that guard against everything from honest mistakes to hyperpartisanship to corruption or the appearance of corruption as it relates to the signature verification process. I support the idea of moving more of the processing of initiative petitions into the Secretary of State's office. From the standpoint of an initiative petitioner, this bill would dramatically streamline the process, improve customer service, and would allow petitioners the benefit of working with specialists who better understand the rules and regulations surrounding the handling of initiative petitions than is currently the case. My experience with the clerks is that some, including Multnomah County, Yamhill County, and others, are very knowledgeable, whereas others have much less experience or resources to handle initiative petitions. I've not yet seen the fiscal impacts of this bill, but I'm told that the signature verification is not a major process for the clerks, and it would seem that streamlining these operations makes financial sense. My personal experiences with the Secretary of State's offices have always been positive. I've never been treated with anything other than the courtesy and respect by professional staff at the office. The people who deal in the initiative petitions or any aspect of electioneering have consistently been willing and capable in their efforts to administer the state's implementations of these basic instruments of our democracy. However, the concentration of this degree of power into the purview of one office makes it essential, in order to guard against corruption or the appearance of corruption, that this body also adopt safeguards to preserve the rights of petitioners, and that recognizes basic due process claims on the part of valid electors who are selected as part of the statistical sampling used by the Secretary of State. The standalone amendment that we've asked to be included in this bill is rather straightforward. The Secretary of State shall allow a qualified elector who is selected collected as part of the statistical sample, but whose signature is rejected during the signature verification process to affirm the signature's authenticity for the purposes of determining whether a state initiative or referendum petition qualifies for the ballot. Notice must be sent to the disqualified elector within 10 days. I think the language has changed a little bit, but that's the gist. I'd like to note a few things about this amendment. It does not elevate the rights of a valid elector who signs an initiative petition to that of a voter. We still use the state's random sampling system. This amendment only applies to people who have had their signatures rejected if they are valid electors who are part of the state's random sample. And there is already in statute a time period for contesting the count on an initiative petition and a process set up for doing so. I think the state has a compelling interest to provide this remedy. The job of the Secretary of State is to ensure the integrity of the process. To leave the office open to charges of corruption or the appearance of corruption is to fail to protect the integrity of the process. Right now, Oregon electors have no guarantee against their signatures being wrongly excluded or excluded for political reasons during the signature verification process, and the decision of the Secretary of State or the clerks is not open to review. The state has already acknowledged that there's an interest in not getting it wrong when it comes to signature verification. Their signature expert testified in the Lemons case that they accept more marginal signatures than they reject. So that being the case, I can see no compelling reason not to offer a remedy to valid electors who signed petitions in good faith and had their signatures wrongfully excluded. I'm thankful that the federal judge has drawn attention to this flaw in Oregon law. I'm thankful to Senator Walker for recognizing the importance of these protections, and I'll be thankful to Senator Brown and to the rest of this committee if you move this bill forward as amended and encourage passage. If there's a cost objection to notifying the few hundred the few hundred electors who may have had their signatures removed as part of the verification process, then I'd encourage the committee to drop the language requiring 10-day notification by the Secretary of State's office while keeping the remainder of the amendment intact. Thanks for hearing my testimony. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Watson, will
I'll defer.
Okay. Ms. Eaton?
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon as the coordinator for governance. We have taken no position on this bill, but there are some comments that we would like to bring to you. We're very much pleased that there is presented to you a cap on the amount of time that the Supreme Court can take in order to bring back a ballot measure that's been challenged. Right now, it's open-ended, and we've seen initiatives actually have to be withdrawn because a ballot title really wasn't coming forth in time for them to do the signatures on it, and we feel that that's certainly a deterrent to the initiative process. So we have no particular preference for either 30 or 45 days, and understand that Senator Walker is working with the Supreme Court to see what would be a reasonable time for them, but we do approve of having some kind of a timeline for the Supreme Court to do that. I'm glad that the Dash 1 amendments have deleted all of the references to the formula process for verifying signatures. It does need to be carefully examined, but we feel it is a valid way in which the Secretary of State and the clerks can look at, in a reasonable way, looking at all the signatures that come in on a particular initiative petition. However, we do want to point out that because of the need for verification coming back into the Secretary of State's office, but going out and coming back, and the need for training, there is a fiscal impact to what's going to happen with signature verification. And I think that we need to recognize that while we have no objection to this particular piece in it, we need to recognize that it is important that the Secretary of State's Election Division have the ability to take on that responsibility, because it will come with some costs. I was very pleased to see the change in the amendments that gave the Secretary of State's office a little more than 90 days to investigate complaints. With one investigator in that office right this moment, 90 days would certainly not be enough to if there are a number of complaints. And so the taking out of the 90 days and inserting 1 year makes a lot more sense to us. I believe those are the comments I'd like to make. But generally, we support the bill, but we are glad to see the amendments that are there.
Thank you. Mr. Wasson.
Thank you very much, Senator Brown, members of the committee. I'm here today mainly to implore you to quit trying to craft statutory fixes to a constitutional problem. The problem with the initiative is that it creates two lawmaking bodies but doesn't require them to work together. The people can veto the legislature for any reason or no reason at all. And when William S. Urin and the others wrote the initiative in 1898, that was exactly what we needed. We needed a way to frustrate, thwart, and take over the legislature. Hopefully, we have progressed to the point where we don't need that anymore. But the initiative powers that exist in 2007 are the same initiative powers that were added to the Constitution in 1902. Until we fix the constitutional problems with the institution, all this other stuff is just spitting in the wind. I agree that as an independent Department of Government, you can't tell the court how it's going to assert its jurisdiction once it's got it. But I do believe that this body can tell the court when it has jurisdiction. So if to craft a timeline with any teeth in it, I think it would have to be that if they don't act in 45 days, bam, the status quo stands. I spent 3 months walking around this building last year trying to get people to listen to me, and to most of you, I'm Greg Hu, and as far as I'm as I might know, the rest of you might not like me very much, but there are today, again, we heard references to the idea that there was not money in the initiative process when it first started. That's just not true. In 1909, $100,000 came into the state from Philadelphia to support an initiative measure. Big money and the initiative process have been partners from the very, very start. The initiative has never been soft and cuddly. And when I listened to the debate on 2082 last session, I just thought, these people just do not understand. And I appeal to you to fix the initiative by fixing the constitutional problems and quit messing around with these statutory fixes.
Thank you. And just for the record, 2082 was the Initiative Reform Modernization Act. So I knew you remembered that one. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us this afternoon. All right. Let's bring up... what are you laughing about, Senator Farrielly? Dan Meek, Mr. Meek, Ms. Coleman, Mr. Hassan. Oops, I'm... Are you in a time frame, Mr. Seja? Okay, thanks. Sorry, I forgot your 100-mile criteria.
Allow John to come up?
If you want to, that'd be great. Thanks.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, I'm Dan Coleman. I'm the Amhill County Clerk, and today I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. The part I would like to address, and I apologize, but what we prepared references the original bill, is the part that says the Secretary of State will update the voter registration addresses from U.S. Postal Records. I guess number one, I want to say that the data, the voter registration data that the Secretary of State possesses belongs to 36 counties. We compiled the data. We keep up the data. And I'm going to assure you that all 36 county clerks are going to tell you that that is our data. It is provided through the OCVR that everyone can see that data, but it still belongs to the counties. On a regular basis, any time we get anything returned from voter files, any kind of correspondence that we get, we either update a voter registration address if we are given that information from the postal sticker that is on that piece of correspondence, or we send a notification to the voter that we have received something that indicates they may have moved. Would you please update your address? This, the biggest thing we get is, of course, return ballots when we have an election, and that occurs quite frequently in Oregon. The second thing we do is memo cards and any type of correspondence that we send to the voter. So this is done all the time. Some of the counties do NCOA. In my county, we do all the notices, plus we do a matching that we do it in county. A lot of the bigger counties are done through mail houses. But we match all our addresses with a postal database that implements the zip plus four and the delivery point to the address so that we can get PostNet barcoding for all of our correspondents, and we qualify for discounts at the post office when we mail. We know the addresses and we maintain those addresses so we can get those discounts. The state is not going to know that, and they certainly are not going to know that for 36 counties. So there really is no reason why the state should be doing this. If you want this to be done, then the county clerk should be doing it to their own information. I guess in a nutshell, that's really what we're about. Annette talked to you, Annette Newingham, yesterday about NCOA and some of the costs, because Mickey from Washington County supplied those. They are probably the ones who have most recently done the NCOA.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Meek?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Meek. I'm, again, representing myself on Senate Bill 10-83. I would support all of the provisions in the bill that pertain to the initiative and referendum process. On the Supreme Court deadline, even in this last cycle, we submitted a couple of ballot measures on June 13th of 2007. We got ballot titles finally in January that was held up for 7 months. Phil Kiesling's measure to change the primary system was held up 6.5 months. So this is definitely a problem, and the delay can cause otherwise viable ballot measures to be completely dropped. On the question of the Secretary of State verifying the signatures, we support that as well. I do believe that the bill needs to restore the language that is removed about sampling. I think the author wishes sampling to continue, so that language should be restored, although I don't believe it's restored in the amendment. On the 90-day period for the Secretary of State or the Attorney General to act on election law complaints, I think this is very important. In our campaign for campaign finance reform, we had an election law complaint filed against us in May of 2006, claiming that our chief petitioners were guilty of paying per signature, a very serious offense. The allegation was that we were paying per signature because we had hired the Arno firm to collect signatures. Of course, that allegation was completely false, and we immediately stated that it was false. That was 22 months ago. The Secretary of State has not ruled yet in that case. And as a result, during the entire campaign, the opponents were able to say that these guys, this campaign in favor of campaign finance reform, they themselves are under investigation for violating state election law. So it's this opportunity for what I think are McCarthyite tactics is allowed because of the unlimited time that the Secretary of State can take to process election law complaints about violations of election law. On the amendments, on the Dash 1 amendments, I would support all parts of the Dash 1 amendments. The part that is on page 3 of the Dash 1 amendments, I would like to make sure that everyone understands what that's about. It says that prior to submitting an initiative or referendum petition for signature verification, a chief petitioner may remove a signature from a petition sheet if the signature is a duplicate of a signature contained on another signature sheet of the same petition, or if the chief petitioner determines that the person who signed is not an elector. The reason that we need this is because of House Bill 2082 from the last session and the provision that was adopted there, what's called the no-writing rule. It said that nobody can write or in any way strike out or obliterate or in any change anything or make any marks at all on a person's on the information about a voter, except the voter him or herself, with the voter him or herself initialing the change. Well, if you do what some folks do, and that is put all of your signatures into a database in order to sort out the duplicates, so you're not dinged 400 signatures per duplicate in the verification process, you have to strike out the duplicate. There has to be some way to show the Secretary of State don't include this signature in the sample. However, HB 2082 would forbid that, so this law allows, again, chief petitioners to strike out signatures if they wish them not to be considered at all. I think that's a good amendment. And finally, on the Dash 2 amendments, this is the one that would essentially require the Secretary of State, once the signature verification process is centralized in the Secretary of State's office, to accord minimal due process to those voters whose signatures are discarded or rejected on the basis that they are not a match of their signature on the voter registration card. The same process occurs in vote by mail, where you end up with 1.5 million votes or so, and the county clerks, in a very swift and short period of time, compare the signatures on each voter's envelope to the signatures on file for the voter registration cards. If there is a conclusion drawn that the signature does not match in vote by mail, that voter is then immediately notified that there was a determination of non-match and is given 10 days to correct the situation, and the corrections can include, according to the vote by mail manual, it says if there's a perceived non-match, that the clerk will send a challenge notice and a registration card to the voter indicating that the signature does not match. Must provide 10-day notice. Notice must be sent not later than the third business day after the date of the election. Resolution requires voter providing sufficient proof in person or by mail with an updated registration card reflecting the voter's signature for matching purposes. We've seen that a significant number of non-matching signatures that are thought to be non-matching when compared to the voter registration card are the result of the evolution of signatures over time. Mm-hmm. And folks can have signed their voter registration card 30 or 40 years ago, and their signature today may be quite a bit different. So in vote by mail, you're able to send in another voter registration card, say, that shows here's what my signature looks like now. If that matches the signature on the outer envelope, not the outer envelope, but the inner envelope of the vote, then that vote counts. So it would appear to me that affording this same level of due process to folks whose signatures are discarded on initiative referendum and recall petitions for that matter, and on all petitions for that matter, is just a minimum level of due process. Now, how difficult would this be? Well, you could implement this provision in one of two ways. One, you could implement it only when it makes a difference. That is, only when the number of non-matching signatures would make a difference between a measure qualifying for the ballot or not qualifying for the ballot. In looking over the situation over the last 20 years in Oregon, I believe that's happened twice. And it would require maybe sending out 200 letters. So sending out 200 letters once every 10 years seems like a minimal burden. However, I would suggest...
For me, when you said there's only been two, what criteria that this has been an issue, can you tell me what criteria you used in that analysis?
I was looking for situations where if the signatures which were rejected solely on the basis of non-matching, a non-matching determination by the county clerks, were instead included in the count, that the measure would qualify for the ballot. If they are excluded from the count, the measure would not qualify for the ballot. And I think experience shows that if you do notify voters or let them know that their signatures are thought to be non-matching, there will be a response, and some percentage of the non-matching signatures will be found to be valid as the result of the response. But it's the number of signatures that are thrown out for non-matching is not a large number. On most statewide initiatives, it's maybe 200 or 300. On the recent referendum 303, it was 55 statewide. But I think this is an extremely important safeguard, particularly if we move signature verification into the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State testified in the Lemons case in federal court. Their witness testified that, her handwriting expert, if she'd been looking at these signatures, she would have thrown out 10 times more than were thrown out by the clerks for non-matching. So if we're going to ratchet up the standard for determining what is a match, then this minimal due process of notifying folks whose signatures are thought to be non-matches, allowing them to respond just like they do with vote by mail, would seem to be absolutely required for due process purposes.
Thank you. So let me make sure I understand that according to the handwriting expert testimony, the number of signatures that she would have thrown out were substantially higher than the number that were actually thrown out. And so your argument is, under due process, that it makes sense to verify the signatures that were excluded but not the signatures that were included.
Chair Brown, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
That is, due process attaches when you have a right that you are being deprived of by government. And the right is the right to sign a petition and have the signature count. If you're being deprived of that right as a result of a determination by a state official, looks at your signature and says that doesn't look enough like your signature to count, then, yes, the voter should be notified that that determination has been made, given an opportunity to challenge it.
Right. Thank you. Thanks. I didn't want to wait to restate that question. Okay, Mr. Hassan, go.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee, Elon Hassan for the Secretary of State's office. And I'm going to testify on some of the concepts in the bill. We got the amendments today, and I know the Deputy Election Director is reviewing them now and comparing them with the rest of the statute. We can have a much more informed answer on details later. But I want to talk about a couple of the concepts. And it's just interesting in this timeline. I was saying the other day, the session feels very much like the first day and the last day of session at the same time. So bear with us.
Yeah.
So on the first issue here, the signature verification process. So let's talk about Lemons for a second here, and to echo some of the things that Mr. Meek said. So they found 11% of petition signatures that were accepted would have been rejected, and 1% of those that were rejected would have been accepted, and there's a good reason for that. When we get a signature that looks like it's going to be rejected, we check it 2, 3, or 4 times because we want to err on the side of not throwing out these signatures. So to balance that, one of the ideas we talked about was, let's have two levels of review for every signature. It's very important that that all Oregonians have the rights to the initiative process. That includes people who were, people whose signatures were rejected may not be electors, so that wouldn't really count, but the people who are sampled, the people who signed the petition, and the people who didn't sign the petition. I mean, all these people have an interest in the initiative process. Having a consistent process across the board is generally helpful. Also in the bill is the idea that the Secretary of State has a verification expert train the folks who are going to be doing the verification, and that there's some sort of I'm not sure if there actually is going to be some kind of certification, but to sort of codify that process. And in terms of being in the Secretary of State's office, again, we've got 36 different counties. There's always going to be some disparity there. So there's going to be less disparity if it's done out of one shop where there can be more control over it. That's something that's generally advisable. Let's see, what else is in here? Just briefly, on the right to remove individual signatures, we get tons of calls in the office over the course of an election of people who said they didn't sign a petition, they want to be taken off it, they didn't know what they were signing, they regret signing, all kinds of things. So under this definition, it's quite limited, and that might be something to address. In terms of the challenge issue and the vote caging issue, you know, for the most part, this is a good idea. I guess, again, without looking at the language at all, only one thing to be made aware of, and I don't know that the bill offends this, but we are a complaint-based system, so there needs to be some level of folks to come in and say, hey, there's a problem out here. We appreciate the citizens of Oregon saying there's a problem in your election system. Unfortunately, a lot of the time this is abused, especially across the country, in a negative manner. And, of course, we'd want to, if we could just cure that part of it, that'd be great. On the extension of time issue, we were talking with the senator. There's the issue which Mr. Meeks brought up, and a lot of folks have expressed interest in quicker adjudication generally. I think the way it's, I don't know how it's written exactly, but the idea is to have within 90 days an up-down or we need more time. It's very important on the articulation of when we need more time. I think the law should say something effect that it's pretty broad how we explain ourselves, because if we give a detailed example of what's wrong with the case, we could prejudice the party who may not have anything wrong with them. So in other words, if we said, well, we need more time to investigate so-and-so's activities into God knows what, like we don't want to come out with something that would later prove to be not a problem. Also, our impression was that under the way it's written now, it applies to all complaints, campaign finance, initiative reform, all the things we do, not just initiative complaints. And I think when the bill comes back with the final amendments on it, one thing to remember is we have a variety of time pressures on our office. The elections are, you know, in November, they're set dates. Campaign finance disclosure are on an ongoing basis, as we all know now. And all these things, as we move up any one of these dates to a higher and higher, less and less time, eventually it's going to require more staff. It's just we're constantly under the gun for one deadline or another. And then finally, there is a reference to changing the words county clerk with state elections official, and I think this has to do with the postal section. It's under 247.563. It's something, this is one of the interesting effects of the clerks and the Secretary of State's. The clerks do a lot of work for the elections process, as I'm sure you all know. I believe a lot of times they send out a notice, a postcard, if and when a voter is moved or something. Bringing the Secretary of State's office, we would be sending out that official notice, a postcard or something. That's fine, but that would be a different dollars. It wouldn't be county dollars, it would be state dollars going out. Those are just the basic, 10,000 foot view of what's going on in the bill. What we see, there are some really good things in the bill, as I hope I've articulated. And if you have any questions, I will do my darndest to answer them.
Thanks, Sir Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've got one bill. I don't remember the number. We heard it yesterday. That would automatically register voters who apply for a driver's license unless they affirmatively refuse to be registered, to opt out. Mm-hmm. And another bill that would prohibit or prevent challenges to the issue of eligibility derived from any list compiled by mail. That's this bill. And citizen activists, I think we want them to own this electoral process. How will they then make a legitimate challenge to voter registration that they think are done fraudulently, illegally, or for some other reason have a feeling that they should be challenged for their validity? How will they then make those challenges?
Thank you, Chair Brown, Senator Farioli. No, that's a good question. That was my concern with the challenge. I don't know the details of this, where one can request lists and where they can't, but that is something we depend on, and I would agree with you that this is, again, we're a complaint-driven process. We rely on the citizens of Oregon to say when something is wrong and when it is not. There's been abuse in that system and over the course of time, and it needs to be looked at. I think that I'm going to have a better answer for you either tomorrow or Monday after the deputy looks more closely at what this law does and how you get there. But that is a concern. We wouldn't want to close off that route.
Senator Farioli. Eliana and I had a great conversation yesterday about the fact that there were 2,600 more votes counted in King County in the last election cycle than there were electors registered. And I'm glad to hear that you've asserted that voter fraud is an ongoing concern and that it does exist. We used to have a system whereby volunteers from the community arrived at the polling place hours before the polling place opened and set up their folding chairs and card tables. And many of them were the League of Women Voters, and many of them were the citizen activists who got involved as poll watchers. And they were there essentially making sure that we had a system of integrity. And I miss those ladies and gentlemen who used to do that. Going to the poll was an experience that I think was even nostalgic now. But I supported vote by mail. I thought that was a way to extend franchise to many, many more people. But it concerns me that we're eliminating opportunities for citizens to guarantee by their own initiative, by their own volunteerism, by their own actions, that there's integrity in the voting system. And, you know, you got a bill over here and a bill over there, and they're seemingly disconnected, but when you put them together, the bottom line is you can't get a list generated from a mailing list that would indicate that people don't live at the places they registered. And I'll point out to the chair, we had 85,000 fraudulent driver's licenses issued through the front door of the Department of Motor Vehicles. And one of the mechanisms that they used to register people for driver's license fraudulently was using a pencil. They penciled in a piece of mail, mailed it, got the cancellation on the stamp, got it back at an address, erased the pencil, and typed in a fraudulent address and used that as a piece of identification to get an Oregon driver's license. And in the system that we're contemplating, they would also have been automatically registered to vote. We need to be able to use whatever mechanisms I think that are available to citizens, activists who wish to do this, and they're both parties, they're non-affiliated people. So if we're going to have a tightening up of the regulations, there still must be a well-defined avenue where ordinary citizens can take the time and trouble to test the system and prove whether it has integrity or not. And what we're doing is cutting those things off one by one. I guess I don't know that all that is necessary. One more question. Have we had evidence of voter caging in Oregon? Have you found it? Has anybody complained? Has there been an investigation that's concluded that caging goes on in Oregon?
Thank you, Chair Brown. Senator Farioli. Yeah, I have not. I haven't read the whole manual, so I don't know if it has happened or not. I can tell you. So I don't know examples of it in Oregon. I can't say if it is or does not exist.
Last observation.
Senator Farioli.
I don't know who these folks are. It's a glossy, slick publication. I don't know who these people are, who paid for this, or whether this is objective information or propaganda. I have no way of knowing that. So this is not a manual.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions?
Just can I say one last thing?
Sure.
We still take no responsibility for King County.
We're still going to find out where those overrun ballots are held and why it is that we separate a secrecy envelope from a ballot before the ballot is counted.
The Deputy Elections Director is listening.
Thank you.
Mr. Meek, I just want to go back to the whole ballot title issue, and I certainly hear your comments and concerns about the delay in the Supreme Court in terms of getting the ballot title written. And one of the issues we've discussed over the last couple of sessions, I don't remember how long, was essentially delaying the ballot title until the signatures are gathered in order to get it on the ballot. I just want to hear your sort of initial gut thoughts to that.
Chair Brown, my thoughts would be that from the point of view of the folks that I work with who have the resources perhaps to put a statewide measure on the ballot once or twice a decade perhaps, requiring them to make the effort and get it on the ballot without knowing what the ballot title would be at all, I think would discourage them a lot.
Okay.
So that would be probably the one of the worst possible ways of doing a ballot title. Ballot titles are extremely important. Our research indicates that it's, you know, it can make a 20% difference in the vote for a measure. So and in our current system with the Attorney General writing the ballot titles and with very broad discretion on what to say, it's very difficult for folks without a lot of resources to make the investment in trying to put a measure on the ballot if when push comes to shove at the end what's on the ballot seems to them to be an unfair or inaccurate ballot title. And if I may, Madam Chair, just make one amendment to my testimony. I said that I supported all the dash one amendments about initiatives and referenda, but I don't support the amendment that allows the Secretary of State or Attorney General to have unlimited time, like an additional year, to investigate complaints. I would recommend that after a 90 or 120-day period, that if the Secretary wishes to take additional time, that he be required to make some kind of a preliminary showing to an impartial magistrate. For example, a circuit court judge, similar to the preliminary hearing process in a criminal case, and not merely be allowed to take yet another year based solely on the desire to take another year. Although I would say that if the limit were 1 year, that would still be an improvement over the existing system. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Anything else? Thank you very much. Mr. Sajo, Mr. Johnson, Ms. Thompson.
Madam Chair, honorable members of the committee, my name is John Sajo. I am the director of a nonprofit organization called Voter Power. We've been involved in registering tens of thousands of voters over the year. I'm also currently a chief petitioner for Initiative 124. I was chief petitioner for a measure back in 1984 and have a couple of just general comments on the initiative process, and that's that basically it's over the years, my perception is that it's become harder and harder to qualify an initiative for the ballot, particularly for a campaign that's based on volunteer citizens. I don't think it's getting harder for big money interests, because if you have $1 million, you can overcome most of the obstacles, but there are many obstacles to, I think, a true grassroots citizens initiating laws. Several times when I've tried to put things on the ballot, I've ended up in court. 3 years ago, we went to court, and essentially tens of thousands of signatures that had been collected were not counted based on the actions of the circulator rather than anything that the signer did, and I think that's a big problem, and I wish there were something that embodied the principle that the actions of a circulator can't disqualify a signer's attempt to have their signature count. As far as the specific bill, you know, we support this bill. I think it's got a lot of good things in it. I think the timeline for the Supreme Court to rule on ballot title challenges, I think people have covered that one. You know, I think that's a very good idea. One of the obstacles to putting a measure on the ballot is not knowing how soon you're going to be able to go out and collect signatures from when you file with that open-ended timeline. Similarly, the timeline for investigation seems to be a reasonable change.
I also strongly support the concept that if a signature is being disqualified and not counted, that there be some sort of due process element where that person gets a chance to say, no, I actually signed it. I think that's very important. I really wish the bill went farther as far as that goes, and I guess I would at least want to toss out the idea that, you know, we're talking about voter registration and voter fraud and all these things, and I've had 20 years of working on petitions and collecting signatures to wonder why it is that if you do a really good job, you get 70% or 80% valid signatures, when no matter how diligent you are about asking people if they're registered. And it seems to me that there's a election law, I believe it's 247.05, that says something to the effect of, it's the policy of the state of Oregon that all election laws and procedures shall be established and construed to assist the elector in the exercise of the right of franchise. And from my experience, it just doesn't work out that way, that there's all sorts of election laws and procedures that make it harder for the elector to exercise their right of franchise. And I think some of them, I think, would be simple to make easier. For example, when I started working on initiative petitions, back before my hair was gray, you could register a voter and have them sign an initiative petition at the same time. And sometime in the 80s, that changed. I don't even think it was a change in the law. I think it was just a change in the form that added the date signed. But that was a huge change that actually makes it much harder for electors to exercise their right of franchise and makes it much harder for the whole system to function, because now if you're out there collecting signatures on an initiative, if you could register people to vote, for one thing, you would get a lot more signatures. But for another thing, there'd be a lot less of this ambiguity. There's a lot of people out there that aren't sure if they're registered to vote. And maybe their signature has changed in the 5 years since they last filled out a card. And if we had the simple change that petitioners could register voters, then you'd have the army of petitioners for all the different causes out there updating people's voter registrations on an ongoing basis. And it seems to me that that would be in the interest of everyone. And I don't see any way that not allowing that does anything other than make it harder for petition circulators and voters to have their votes counted. So I hope in the long run that we can look at that. But again, I support the changes in 1083 and the amendments, and I want to thank Senator Walker for bringing these forward. I hope that some more of these things, some more changes can be made to, you know, make the initiative process again be what it's supposed to be, which is a mechanism where grassroots citizens can create laws, and it's getting harder and harder. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anthony Johnson. I'm political director of Voter Power. I come in support of Senate Bill 1083 because Oregon has a great tradition of treating its citizens as a co-equal branch of the government. Unfortunately, the right to initiative petition, which is a great foundation of that treatment, has been eroded in recent years, and Senate Bill 1083 is a common sense, rational approach to start restoring that great tradition. So I applaud Senator Walker for bringing forth this bill. Otherwise, I agree with the comments earlier from Mr. Dan Meek and the comments of Mr. John Sagio. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Thompson.
Janice Thompson, Democracy from Oregon. I want to focus my comments on Section 7, and what was Section...
Is this of the original bill?
The original bill.
Okay.
And Section 4 of the original bill. Just on the other items, as others have stated, you know, these long timelines for both finalizing ballot titles and investigations are very, very frustrating. So definitely liked, you know, the concept in the bill is written, and, you know, but it had some concerns about, you know, due process and, you know, workability and whatnot. So it sounds like the amendment process underway on both of those are heading in the right direction. So I look forward to seeing those amendments in terms of, you know, final comments on that. And others have far more experience than I do with the initiative and referendum stuff, so I think you're hearing, you know, so I'm not going to venture into that either. In terms of the Section 7, so, you know, this is similar to a provision in a bill that was before you yesterday, and I think, you know, the general comments I made then apply, which is a real interest in, you know, proactive and consistent procedures for using postal service information to update addresses that I happened to mention yesterday. You know, that I, for example, recently moved my office and shifted to having both a physical mail, you know, location as well as a P.O. box. And I kind of went through and tried to do as many change of addresses as I could, but just not too long ago, realized that one vendor I dealt with, I hadn't done that, so I was talking to them, and they had it all. And so, I mean, I think businesses are already doing this with this information as a, you know, cause as a customer service angle. They want to make sure that, you know, if they've got something they want to mail to me, that it's going to the right place, and if they have some delivery, they want to make to me that it's going to the right place. So I think that one way to look at this whole issue is, you know, as a customer service element. As I mentioned yesterday, I'm kind of agnostic about who does it, county, you know, or at the state level. I continue to be troubled by the discussion in 247.292 about, you know, there being some things that you can do if the update is within one county, and, you know, that those elements just strike me as being remnants of when there was not a centralized voter database. So I just think that, you know, I think taking a look at this, moving this to the state level needs to be addressed, given that we do have this centralized voter database. In terms of the vote caging, there's just, I can supply the committee the URLs, I can't remember them off top of my head, but the Brennan Center for Justice has also has analysis of the topic, and in terms of Senator Ferrioli's question, they have a June 2007 summary of reported instances that does not include any Oregon-specific examples. So I think this is an issue where, you know, I think the whole notion that this is a complaint-driven process, I guess I'm not seeing that this language shifts that. It's just saying that one tool used to develop the information for a complaint is not cannot be used. And, again, the Brennan Center, in its analysis of it, in their, you know, lawyerly academic kind of way, they're, you know, affiliated with the New York NYU School of Law, just have, you know, documented that the voter caging process is just very unreliable. So I think this may well be one of those situations where you need to decide if you want to kind of put, you know, have something in here that you know, kind of just sets up some different parameters. And primarily, I think, especially in the amendments, it's just really trying to shift it, like you have some personal knowledge. Some of the other provisions up in Washington State is that, you know, there's been some due diligence to really check your information, like if the concern is about, you know, somebody was voting from an incorrect address. So I think the amendments on that score, you know, are also heading in the right direction. But it may be one of those areas where, you know, the decision needs to be made if you want to, you know, do something and prevent some problems, or wait and react. And so that's, I think, you know, a question for the group in terms of this voter caging. But I'm not seeing it as, you know, completely upending, you know, people's ability to file, register legitimate complaints.
Okay. Questions?
More an observation, Madam Chair. Thank you. In this discussion, the Secretary of State could use postal records for the random updating of voter rolls, but a citizen or party or agent or designee or other person, so there's a pretty comprehensive list here, prohibitions, could not use those same records to formulate a challenge.
Did you want to respond, Mr. Simpson?
Yes, Senator, Chair Brown, Senator Ferrielli, thanks. I actually was going to mention along those lines in the Brennan Center documentation, there is recognition of this point and that there are guidelines set out in the National Voter Registration Act about how states, as part of upgrading their systems, use mailing and lists and things like that. I think, though, the other factor there that I think, you know, as the discussion continues, as I hope it does, on this more proactive, consistent, I mean, I think the bottom line is you want the ballot to go to the correct address, and I think, but your point I think is raising is a good one in terms of the automatic, and that's why yesterday I, you know, tossed out the idea, given the timeline, of maybe having a period of time where there's some test runs, and I think so. I think there are some. You know, the question of automatic and including a confirmation by the voter, I think, is definitely an area that needs further discussion.
Senator Ferriel?
A question for the other panel members. Thank you, Madam Chair. Should there be a clearly defined mechanism for ordinary citizens to be able to challenge the validity of an elector if we're going to adopt a regulation that eliminates the use of postal service records? Should there be a clearly defined mechanism for ordinary citizens to be able to challenge elector validity?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrielli, I have to just honestly say I don't really have much experience with that end of it. My experience is with more trying to register new voters, and my perspective is that should just be easier than it is. So I don't know about that.
Okay, if you don't know, just say I don't know.
I don't know.
And then move on.
Wish you'd been here yesterday when we were talking about how do we get new voters registered. So you missed a great discussion.
Madam Chair, Senator Fioroli, I don't know.
Okay. Well, my concern, Madam Chair, is that it sounds like we're aiming at problems that may or may never have existed in Oregon. And it also looks like we're eliminating processes that, which would be fine to eliminate as long as there's a clearly defined mechanism that Oregon's ordinary citizens can engage in if they do want to become activists in voter roll integrity. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify this afternoon? All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1083. In terms of folks who are watching these issues on Tuesday of next week, the date is the 12th, we will be having public hearings and possible work sessions on the following bills: Senate Bill 1070, Senate Bill 1071, Senate Bill 1083, and Senate Bill 1098. So this will be the last opportunity to move forward on those bills. So get your amendments ready.
It'll be the first opportunity to move forward on these.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, for some of the bills, the first time, first and last. As Mr. Hassan said, this feels like the first day of session and the last day of session. All I can say is, Mr. Hassan, there's a lot of people in this building that are feeling your pain, and we'll be finalizing our work on those bills on Tuesday, so stay tuned. Thanks, everyone. Anything else to come before the committee today? Not seeing any squeals? We're adjourned. Thanks.
Thank you for your courtesy, ma'am.